Our fifth case for this morning is Prather v. Sun Life Financial. Mr. Dubofsky.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Dubofsky. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Leanne Prather. 25 years ago, this court decided the Sankier v. Hartford case, which stands for the proposition that accidental death insurance does not extend to death that occurs during the course of medical treatment. But in that opinion, a hypothetical was posed. The hypothetical said, but it would be different if he twisted his knee playing tennis and the injury caused blood clots that embolized to his lungs and killed him. Following the hypothetical, the court cited several cases that dealt with circumstances where somebody experienced a traumatic injury, underwent medical treatment, subsequently died, either in the course of the medical treatment or as a complication of the medical treatment, and the courts in those cases all found that the accidental death insurance policy extended to provide indemnity in those cases, because the initial accident, the initial traumatic injury, was what mattered.
So do you know if the forensic pathologist who examined Jeremy considered whether surgery contributed to his death?
The forensic pathologist in her report, Dr. Humans, specifically mentioned that she saw the signs of the surgery, and there's not a word in her conclusions attributing the surgery to the cause of death. Neither did Ms. Herring, actually, in her report. Ms. Herring, the medical examiner for the insurance company, in her report stated that a deep vein thrombosis is a risk of the surgery that Mr. Prather underwent, but she never explicitly concluded that that was the cause of death.
So the line you're drawing is that you can talk about risks, but you're saying that what they needed to do was take the next step and say, this risk came to pass.
Yes.
This risk happened. So, you know, if getting a rash is a risk of taking cold medicine, not everybody who takes cold medicine gets a rash. So you need to need more information.
Yes. Absolutely.
Should we presume that Jeremy's surgeon would not have performed the surgery if he thought that a deep leg thrombosis had already occurred?
I would assume so, but we don't know from the record.
We don't have that answer.
All we have in the record is the call that was made the day before the surgery.
The July 21 call.
Correct. Mr. Prather complained about the symptoms that he was experiencing.
He was worried.
The doctor called in and said, we'll take a look before the surgery, and then, boom, surgery takes place. There's not even a record of an examination that took place before the surgery. In addressing Your Honor's question, Judge Wood, I think the key here, the one that you posed a minute ago, I think the key here is the structure of the policy. Under the structure of this policy, Jeremy Prather's beneficiary, Leanne Prather, was entitled to indemnity so long as Jeremy Prather sustained a bodily injury that resulted directly from an accident. Everybody concedes that that took place here, and that was independent of all other causes. Everybody concedes that took place here. The medical examiner ruled out Mr. Prather's other potential medical conditions as a cause, as did Ms. Herring in her medical analysis that she completed.
So you're talking now about whether this language under the restrictions section that says we will not pay for any loss that is caused either directly or indirectly or contributed to by blah 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 medical or surgical treatment, whether who had to bear the burden on that, right?
And that's what I was going to get
to. That's what I thought. Yeah.
Because once Mrs. Prather proved that her husband died as a result of this injury that he experienced playing basketball, and the medical examiner concluded that this was an accident and that the underlying cause was the torn Achilles tendon playing basketball.
And the record also shows that deep vein thrombosis is possible from this kind of accident alone before anybody touches you medically.
Ms. Herring conceded it. In answering the questions that were posed to her, she immediately went to, but this can occur as a result of immobility. And the medical literature supports that as
well. Because how many days gap between when he got the injury, just remind me, was it 5 or 6 days gap between the injury and the actual surgery?
5 days to the surgery, and then another 5 days or...
But I mean, I'm just talking about that
six
gap.
Six days to the surgery, and then...
Five days to the phone call about the swelling.
Right. The swelling. But, yeah. But no, that could develop in those days of inactivity, because that was 5 days with no mobility on that.
Presumably, yes. And mm-hmm. and that's the problem with defendant's position in this case.
So they're let me ask you an ERISA-type question here. I'm going to assume for the sake of this question that we are dealing with a policy that gives discretion so that we're under the arbitrary and capricious standard of review. What is it that the claims administrator, Sun Life here, should have done? Did they need to at least find what I might call substantial evidence that this was a surgical complication, not just a straightforward problem from the original accident? Did they need to actually show by a preponderance that it was more likely a surgical complication? What's missing in your view?
Evidence.
Well, but what is that evidence? How strong, if instead of going to this physician's assistant, whose report I find quite inconclusive, but suppose they'd gone to a doctor, and the doctor had said, deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism is a risk factor for the surgery. And in my opinion, that's what happened. Doesn't actually tell you why that's his or her opinion, but would that be enough to make you lose?
No.
What do they have to do? Because there's not that much evidence, right? You know.
They have to give a rationale. There has to be something that connects their theory that the cause of death fell within this exclusion.
Well, they have that. What would he have been safer if he had been immobilized instead of operated on?
We have no idea.
What do you mean you have no idea? What does the medical profession say about that?
The medical profession says immobilization alone increases the risk mm-hmm. of a deep vein thrombosis. We also know that it's a known surgical complication of the surgery, that he could develop a deep vein thrombosis.
So you say there's no difference so far as risk is concerned between immobilization and surgery?
The medical literature that I researched didn't show any conclusive evidence one way or the other. But the death occurred as a result of the immobilization, not the surgery. The surgery happened after the accident.
No, I'm talking about
accident.
Immobilization without surgery.
I understand that.
That's an alternative way of dealing with
this problem. And if indeed that's what happened, then I don't think that we would be standing here today, because the conclusion would be the accident led to the immobilization, which led to the death. There wouldn't have been any medical treatment. And then there wouldn't have been any basis for invoking the exclusion.
I don't understand you. Well, the immobilization is supposed to be a way of dealing with the problem that might be less likely to result in a pulmonary embolism.
But actually, you're saying the medical literature doesn't.
No, the immobilization is
a
risk factor for the pulmonary embolism. Just like. It's a known.
But is it less of a risk factor than the surgery?
I don't think anybody knows that. I don't think the literature is clear on that.
It's
so,
important,
so
isn't
if,
it?
If Mr.
Well, it
Prather,
is important. If there had been medical testimony, if you'd gotten an expert test, you know, if the administrator had gotten an expert to look at, the administrator might have said, well, in his case, he's already got signs of deep vein thrombosis on July 21st. So in his particular case, the immobilization had already caused the problem, and maybe the surgery either made it worse or didn't do anything or whatever. Maybe the expert would say the opposite. Maybe the expert would say the risk is, you know, X for immobilization and greater than X for surgery. But no one looked at that. There's no evidence that immobilization in his particular case was a kind of strategy that was automatically better.
That's absolutely correct. If, let's say,
surgery is a standard source of pulmonary embolism, knee surgery, for example, that's a typical consequence. Because they're, you know, they're mucking around with your veins, and something, you know, floats up to your heart. So I would have thought, my impression was that immobilization in lieu of surgery was somewhat safer than the surgery.
We don't know.
So there's no evidence in the record. Mm-hmm.
And the defendant didn't come up with any evidence that would have specifically linked the surgery to Mr. Prather's death.
And the only evidence or statement in the record is that immobilization can cause such an embolism.
Exactly.
Which was the state it was in.
Exactly.
Until the surgery.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dubofsky. Ms. Kirsting.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, opposing counsel. Obviously, we take a
very... You'll have to speak louder.
Obviously, we take a very different position relative to this case.
But, you know, the problem is this statement from Ms. Herring in response to the question, can we conclude that his subsequent surgery to repair the tendon rupture played no part? She says, no, you can't conclude that. And then she just says, the risks of surgery included DVT and PE, deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolism. But she never says that that happened in his case. And I see a real distinction between saying that something is a risk and saying something that took place. And if you read, you know, if you ever watch TV and you see the ads for prescription drugs, they tell you, oh, this could be a great drug, you know, for your asthma or something. And then at the end of the ad, they go through this lengthy, ghastly list usually of, you know, but... You know, you may have shortness of breath, and you may get rashes, and you may have diarrhea, and you may faint, and you may, you know, do all these other things. And they're all risks, but they don't come about every time. And this record is devoid of evidence that this man, who already has a sign that deep vein thrombosis is happening, was made worse off somehow by the operation. There's just no evidence.
Mm-hmm. With all due respect,
certainly not Ms. Herring's statement, which I'm looking at.
I disagree on two parts, Your Honor. First of all, I disagree with the premise that he had signs of deep vein thrombosis during his phone call on July 21. He called in solely to report on the status of his swelling, given the fact that his doctor had told him that if the swelling continued, at that point, they might need to reschedule the surgery.
So what do you think swelling means?
Swelling in and of itself is caused
swelling
by the rupture of a tendon.
Swelling means that there's fluid in your tissues, and there's not enough room to hold that fluid within a confined area. It's confined by your skin, right? So it swells up, and this fluid is coming out. It could indicate internal bleeding. It could indicate other kinds of sources of fluid. But that's what swelling is. Muscles don't just, like, balloon up and become bigger.
Of course. He had a ruptured Achilles tendon, Your Honor. Of course he experienced swelling.
So there's bleed. I'm saying that the swelling itself is the bleeding. It's the discharge of fluid into the body.
I understand, but nonetheless, however,
and so
every single
the fluid is discharging. The body is also trying to mend it. And there's some indication that his report on July 21st was something that was a sign that maybe some added risk of a deep vein thrombosis is already happening. It's pre-surgery.
I disagree.
And there's
with
also
that. He
evidence
experienced
in the record.
Swelling as a result of a rupture, Your Honor.
Yeah, but he also said it was warm and it was tender. And
but
so
that
that's
is also normal
with,
as a result
right,
of
but
a
it's
rupture.
Also consistent
so
with
is deep vein thrombosis.
It would be.
Right.
But all other symptoms that the doctor, that the nurse specifically asked him about, he denied. He denied streaking. He denied shortness of breath. He denied fever. He denied chills.
Well, he says he's warm to the touch, so mm-hmm. he's sort of only partially.
Well,
he's been immobilizing the leg, and deep vein thrombosis you know, it's a big issue with people who like to take long airplane rides, you know, who are advised to get up and move around, don't stay still. I mean, it's a well-understood phenomenon.
I understand, Your Honor. I just simply do not believe that an orthopedic surgeon, when he hears Mr. Prether's report in this case, would say, just elevated, it is all fine, just come in tomorrow, we're going to take a look, and if nothing is going on, we'll proceed the surgery. If there was any suspicion, any suggestion that there was a deep vein thrombosis going on here, this was an obese gentleman. This was somebody who had heart issues. With a deep vein thrombosis, there would have been a prescription of warfarin. There would have been something done. There would have been a Doppler.
We hope. But there's no finding in the record. You've just right now added all sorts of things. It would have been great if some actual medical professional, maybe you have a medical degree, but if a medical professional had said the things that you said, maybe you would have evidence in the record. Instead, all we have is Ms. Herring, a physician's assistant, saying that one of the risks of surgery is DVT and PE. Doesn't say, and he understands that that's a risk. It doesn't say it happened. It doesn't say that's when it happened. It doesn't say anything.
Autopsy report, Your Honor.
And the autopsy report ties it back to the Achilles tendon rupture.
It gives us a time frame for the
July
deep vein thrombosis.
July 16th through August 6th.
No,
weeks.
It says days. Days within death. The deep vein thrombosis, according to Dr. Yeomans in this case, developed days prior to death.
Could either be the immobilization or the surgery. It doesn't tie it to the surgery without expert testimony to tie it to the surgery. There's no expert testimony.
After surgical treatment, there was surgical treatment done. Surgical treatment is
you don't know the surgical treatment is the most likely or whether the immobilization that follows after the surgical treatment, maybe the surgical treatment didn't move the risk up at all.
That is highly unlikely.
I don't know. There's no evidence. There's no doctor.
Was any doctor willing to testify that if he had not had the surgery, he would not have had the pulmonary embolism?
This case did not involve any.
What?
This case did not involve any discovery, Your Honor.
So there's no testimony in the record. The company didn't bother to collect anything like that.
No doctor, just the physician's assistant, which is really troubling because the physician's assistant never said the surgery actually caused or contributed to his death. And so I'm having a hard time finding, you know, determining, you know, what was the basis of the denial of benefits. Because that's what you had, a physician's assistant who really didn't, I mean, first, wasn't qualified, in my opinion, to opine on this. And second, she never really said that the surgery actually caused or contributed to his death.
I think she does. By denying that it does not play a part, she admits and opines that it does.
No, that's not quite the way the question's phrased. The question's phrased, can we conclude that it played no part? And she just says no because sometimes this is an outcome. And then she just goes on to say, it's clear from the records that he understood the risk as he voiced his concern a day before surgery. She never says what Judge Posner was suggesting.
She denies that we can conclude that it played no part. If I turn that around, as she opines that we cannot conclude.
What's the standard of proof? Suppose the doctor says that there's a 20% chance that the pulmonary embolism was caused by the surgery. Is that enough?
I would say it's a reasonableness standard.
Insurance company off the hook?
This is an arbitrary and capricious case.
Pardon?
It's an arbitrary and capricious case, which means that even if my client should have the burden of proof relative to the exclusion/restriction language, it cannot be a preponderance of the evidence, as that would turn the entire reasonableness consideration and the issue of deference on its head.
I don't
understand. So given my client's still deference.
I don't get it. What kind of evidence is necessary to show that the surgery, rather than the accident, caused the pulmonary embolism?
Usually it's substantial evidence under the case law. I believe that there is substantial evidence in this case. I believe my client's position is reasonable based on what's in front of him.
There's no evidence, right?
Well, there's the timeline provided by Dr. Yeomans.
There's no one can draw the connection. All you can say is that the surgery created some probability of that was the cause of the pulmonary embolism. I'm just wondering what probability is required. Does it have to be more than 50%?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Can it be
10%? A reasonable decision can be a reasonable...
Well, how would courts decide cases like this? There's no standard of proof.
Well, the standard of proof is reasonableness.
How could a case like this ever be decided in favor of the victim?
Well, Judge Mills believed that it was reasonable. My client's decision was reasonable based on the evidence in this case. I believe that too. The standard is not preponderance of the evidence. My client does not have to show that it was more likely than not that the surgical treatment contributed to the development.
But your client, under your view, as long as something is a known risk of a procedure or a medication, you automatically get to deny coverage, even if that risk never came to pass. People get a rash, even if only some people get a pulmonary embolism, as long as it's somewhere in the universe of risk that's recognized by the FDA or that's recognized by the medical profession, you get to deny. That's your position, as I understand it.
That is
you don't have any evidence.
No, but that's what you're saying, because
you don't have any evidence that in this man's case, the operation triggered a deep vein thrombosis and then it broke loose and caused the pulmonary embolism.
I do know that it developed after surgical intervention. I do know that surgical intervention...
We don't even know that because there were no tests or anything performed at the hospital. There's nothing in the record. There was no Doppler or anything.
Well, then the question comes back to the lady that conducted the autopsy, Dr. Yeomans. Was she right or was she wrong? If we're saying, well, she did not address surgery, we're going to rely on that. We also have to rely on the fact that she said that the deep vein thrombosis developed days before his death.
Right, but he's been immobilized all that time too.
Yeah, but that's subsequent to the surgery. So we do know it developed subsequent to the surgery.
But now you're saying everything that happened subsequent to the surgery has to have been because of the surgery. It can't be because of the immobilization, even though that's one of the things that causes these blood clots to form within the circulatory system.
Well, the surgery is one of the foremost reasons.
Well, so is immobilization.
Immobilization is not one of the foremost reasons.
But here's, again, from you. Great. I mean, if that were, if things like that were in the record
from somebody qualified, then we would have
a different case.
That surgery is one of the foremost
reasons. Well, now you're wading
into
very dangerous territory in this court because you're suggesting that we should go out and check all the websites we can find and come to our own medical conclusion, which I don't think you really want to say.
Generally, medical information can be considered in the connection with diseases, just as we do in disability cases, I believe. Medical information relative to the effects of prescription drugs, for example, can be considered by a court.
No, it's not fair to bring you into this debate. I think we will take this and see if Mr. Dubosky has anything else.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does he have any more time? I'll give you 1 minute, Mr. Dubosky, because we've run over on both sides.
So what do you think is the standard of proof?
I think the standard of proof is substantial evidence.
What does that mean?
Well, unfortunately, the courts have been pretty weak in explaining what substantial evidence means. More than a scintilla, but enough to satisfy a reasonable mind is the standard that's used generally in substantial evidence in reviewing administrative decisions. There has to have been more. There has to have been an opinion here that said that the surgery was a contributing cause, not that the surgery was a risk.
So is it? But what is the standard proof when you say it was?
The standard
more than 50% probability?
Absolutely.
Well, but I mean, I think you have to say there has to have been. If you're going to take the administrative analogy, which is what we've done in the arbitrary and capricious cases, there has to be at least one witness who says, I'm a qualified witness, doctor, in my opinion, it's more likely than not that the surgery contributed. And then maybe other people don't think so, or they didn't say so, so maybe on the record as a whole it wouldn't hit preponderance. But you, a substantial evidence means you've got to have some evidence somewhere in the record that would support the finding.
Exactly. And that evidence is completely non-existent in this record. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.